Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today's episode is presented by Meta.
A virtual reality platform created by Fundamental VR and Orbis International helps train doctors to treat cataracts, resulting in more confident surgeons operating worldwide. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
Hey everyone. Welcome back to EU Confidential, the number one EU news and politics podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Heath, author of Politico's Brussels Playbook column. It's been a strange week, frankly. For me, it was great. I've been down in Lisbon, Portugal for the last 3 days at Web Summit. That's the biggest tech event in the world where gadgets meet politics. The big themes there were man versus machine. And while countries like the UK and Portugal both lost their empires decades ago, they were the ones making a big play for new digital empires. Elsewhere in Europe, it was a bit odd. The UK government is just lurching from drama to drama, ones that we can't really predict. The German government coalition talks are going nowhere fast. And here in Brussels, there's been a lot of veiled threats from all sides around whether the weed killer glyphosate should be approved for continued use. But first, we're going to turn to Kyriakos Mitsotakis for our feature interview this week. He's the leader of the opposition in Greece. For the centre-right New Democracy Party that held power until early 2015, when Greeks kicked out the establishment and elected the radical Syriza government of Alexis Tsipras. Welcome to the podcast, Mr. Mitsotakis.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
A lot of people, they're skeptical of Greece as a result of what's gone on over the last 10 years. You're telling me that Greece is reformable and that you have a plan to do it.
Yeah, well, to a certain extent, I understand the skepticism regarding Greece. Greece was the first country that entered into a program, and it's still the only European country that is in a program. The crisis has been going on now for 7 years. Unfortunately, the economy found itself again in a recession in 2016. As Europe is growing at a good pace, Greece is really struggling to catch up. Having said that, I do need to point out that back in 2014, we were very close to actually exiting the program and turning the corner, and if it were not for the current government.
And that was back when your party, New Democracy, was still in government.
New Democracy was still in power. At the time, the economy was growing. We had started to lower taxes. There was a general sense of optimism. We had already negotiated at the time a precautionary credit line. There was a general sense that things were moving in the right direction. Unfortunately, we lost 3 years, and that is the cost of the current government. No matter how you count it, it's probably anywhere close to 100 billion euros. If you just look at our GDP numbers, where we could have been and where we currently are, there is a GDP gap of close to 30 billion euros. If you just look at the projections of the European Commission back in 2014, they were predicting at the time that the economy would grow at 2.9 and 3.6% in 2015-2016. Mm-hmm. We had a recession in both years. So we paid a very heavy bill for experimenting with Mr. Tsipras. But again, I think Greeks understand this. They're looking for a credible political alternative. And right now, my main agenda is to convince, first of all, the Greek population, mm-hmm, that A, Greece is reformable, B, we should embrace a bold reform agenda, and we should own the reform agenda, and that this reform agenda is good for the country, and is not a reform agenda that we need to implement by necessity because it is imposed by our creditors. This is a very central theme of my narrative.
And is it big ticket items, like we're going to change the tax system completely to get more people paying those taxes, or is it smaller things? You've had a big track record in public administration reform.
I think it's a little bit of everything. First of all, there's an issue of seriousness, competence, professionalism in governance. and government, which for me is a big issue. You know, I'm a liberal by definition. I want a smaller and more efficient government. I want to streamline public spending. I want to cut taxes. I want to make Greece an attractive investment destination. So all the issues that, if you just look at, you know, the World Economic Forum ranking, mm-hmm. why isn't Greece an attractive investment destination today? You know, the problem also highlights the solution. Highly bureaucratic licensing mm-hmm. process in place, which I intend to grossly streamline, a complicated tax code, which I also intend mm-hmm. to greatly simplify, and also to start reducing tax rates, privatizations that never move in the right direction, mm-hmm. lots of roadblocks within the public administration yeah. that I...
Because Greeks are known as being very entrepreneurial. If I think of Greece, you know, beyond the beautiful islands and the sun that you give to the world, like, I think of Greeks as very entrepreneurial people. So well, it's surprising that it's not allowed out.
I think you're right to point out there is a lot of dynamism in Greece today, in spite of the crisis. There is a resurgence in entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. which I find extremely encouraging. Lots of young Greeks who want to set up their own businesses rather than finding a cozy job with the public administration. So there has been a change in attitude in Greece, and I think the underlying trends in Greek society are very much in favor of our agenda. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there's a perception, which to a certain extent is true, that there is an oligarchy, a business oligarchy mm-hmm. in Greece, that there are barriers to entry, mm-hmm. that product markets have not been liberalized. These issues need to be addressed, and I'm going to be, you know, very bold in making sure that there is a level playing field for everyone. I don't want, you know, foreign investors to feel that they necessarily need to team up with a prominent Greek political family to mm-hmm. do business in Greece, or that they need to own, mm-hmm. I don't know, a TV channel or yep. a media outlet. That's not the way things should or need to function in Greece.
Now, I had dinner last night with some young Europeans, so people from all over the place. And the group I ended up talking to at the end of the night were a group of young Greeks. And I said, I'm interviewing the man who could be your next prime minister tomorrow. Like, what do you want me to ask him? And they said, you know, they're open to you as prime minister, was what they said. But they said, like, why would he be different? You know, he comes from the same party that was in power for a long time. He comes from a famous political family himself. You know, like, make him tell us why he'd be different.
Yeah, I think this, first of all, it's a fair question. Because I do come from a political family. Having said that, my career is not the typical career of a professional politician. I was educated in the US and I spent 10 years working in the private sector before I entered politics. At the same time, I'm also considered a bold reformer within my own party. Mm-hmm. So I am changing my own party. And this sometimes, I'll be very honest with you, is causing friction.
Yeah. And you weren't expected to win when you ran for the leadership, were you?
I was a complete outsider. Nobody thought I could win. Mm-hmm. Not a single MP from my parliamentary group supported my candidacy.
I don't want to give a Jeremy Corbyn analogy here, but it sounds a bit like Jeremy Corbyn on the right.
I came from nowhere, but I did manage to, in an open primary, I did manage to mobilize a lot of people who do not belong to my party. Yeah. And I make the case to my party that I received a clear mandate to change the party. What does changing a party mean? First of all, it means getting in new talent and new people, being open to new policy ideas, and streamlining our basic sort of ideological proposition with what is necessary today in Greek society. I do want to move my party towards the political center. I'm very clear on that, on that front. That's where I think elections are always won and lost. So my effort to modernize the party is sometimes causing friction. Mm-hmm. That means I'm moving in the right direction, and we've taken a lot of initiatives to bring in new talent. So we have an open registry for people. We ask people to just send us their CV and mm-hmm. a little, you know, a YouTube video of why they want to get involved in mm-hmm. politics. We've interviewed, through a formal interview process, more than 1,500 mm-hmm. people who tell us that they want to get engaged in politics in one way or another. Yeah. They may want to be candidates, or they may want to help mm-hmm. as technocrats. So I think I'm breaking up this image of New Democracy mm-hmm. as an old, stale, traditional party, which, by the way, I think all mainstream political parties mm-hmm. need to do.
It's a bit like Emmanuel Macron, that opening up process.
Yes, although the
maybe not
the
ideologically, but
started from scratch.
Yes,
he started his own yeah. party. I'm very proud to be leader of Nea Dimokratia. It's a party mm-hmm. that has contributed a lot, I think, to Greece. We should not forget that it was Konstantinos Karamanlis, our founder, who pushed Greece into the European Economic Community at the time against the wish of the Greek population.
Mm-hmm. Now, because of the economic situation, the program or the bailout, whatever language is the best one to use, it kind of matters that people outside of Greece have confidence in you as well. So I wanted to do a little quick world tour there. What do you think your relationship is like with people like Angela Merkel or those people who sit around the Eurogroup table and make decisions about, is Greece finally out of this program? You know, can they have debt relief and so on?
I think I have a very good, honest and transparent relationship with the European leadership. And it is important for them to get to know me and for me to get to know them. And I think I have avoided mistakes made by other Greek politicians when they were in the opposition.
Mm-hmm.
I'm clearly not overpromising. If anything, I'm presenting a very credible long-term reform program. I think that European leaders and world leaders want, you know, a credible, serious interlocutor in Greece. And there's also another dimension. I don't just want to participate in this debate about the new Europe that is shaping up by being sort of the poster boy for Europe's problems.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have a lot of positive ideas to add to this discussion, especially when it comes to issues such as common defense policy.
And you hit the Trump target for NATO. I mean, he makes a huge deal of hitting that target.
We spend more than 2% on defense for obvious reasons. So
I hope you didn't call him a liar. That might be that might undo some of the goodwill.
Always careful not to intervene in campaigns by making any sorts of comments. But Greece is a country that needs to be at the forefront of this new agenda regarding the common defense policy as it is developed. So we want to contribute positively to this agenda. We don't just want to be, you know, a country whose name pops up only because there is a crisis.
And one final huge country I should mention, because we tend to forget it too often in Europe, China. They've just finished up their once every 5 years Communist Party Congress. It's a country with a 30-year plan now. Like, it makes, sometimes I look at what the EU does, and even when it tries to do its 2-year or its 5-year plans, and then China's got a 30-year plan. It's quite incredible. And I know that the current Greek government has, you know, laid quite a few bets in trying to get Chinese investment into the country. What do you see as the role for China in Greece? Is it just one of many countries? Would you do it differently to the current government?
It's look, Greece needs to attract 100 billion in investment, foreign and domestic, over the next 6 to 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, China does not have any preferential treatment.
Mm-hmm.
But to the extent that Greek assets are up for sale and all processes are being followed, I'm not, in principle, hostile to Chinese investment. I should point out that the Chinese have invested in the Port of Piraeus, and they have done a good job.
And they're doing huge infrastructure
they
works.
Have,
you look at the
have,
Silk
but,
Road.
But they're not the only investor in Greece, and they should not also be the only investor in Greece. So I'll be very, very happy if I can generate more interest for European investment in Greece. If anything, I want to see competition for Greek assets. And there is a lot of room to attract investment from the US, but in particular from Europe. And I do spend a lot of my time talking to business chambers and big European corporates about what it means to invest in Greece. And it doesn't always mean buying assets. It could mean setting up, you know, a data center or a shared service center in the region, as certain European companies have done. We have extremely skilled and relatively cheap labor. And I can't imagine many nicer places to have a regional headquarter than Greece. I don't think this government has either the will or the skill to talk about a private investment and to embrace a liberal agenda, because, you know, when they come to Brussels, they may say we're committed to the program, but when we go back to Greece, there are always all sorts of problems created for any meaningful investment that is taking place in Greece. So you can't just speak two languages, you know, one language abroad and one language to your, you know, leftist radicals within the party. It doesn't work that way.
And so your big challenge in the election that I'm guessing will happen next year, but it could happen as late as 2019, is to really show to Greek voters that there are these two stories being told by the current government, and to win them over to your side. Who do you think will be the biggest threat for you in that election? Is it the current government? Is it this new centre-left movement that the mayor of Athens is trying to get forward? Is it the EU and the threat of the bailout program and the restrictions that puts on your ability to make promises?
I still think that as much as Tsipras tries to shift his party more towards the centre-left, it's going to be difficult to deliver on this agenda, but he's still the incumbent prime minister and he is still my principal political opponent. And at the end of the day, people don't just vote for parties, they also vote for candidates for the job of prime minister. I don't know what will happen with the centre-left. They're in the process of looking for a new party leader, but I will refrain from making any comments. You know, I do hope that they get their act together. The more parties we have that, in spite of our differences, are pro-European and pro-reason and against populism, I think the better it will be for the quality of our democracy.
Kyriakos Mitsotakis, thank you very much for joining us on EU Confidential.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ryan.
And now it's time for our podcast panel. We're going to do our EU WTF moments, our EU thumbs up, and our Dear Politico advice session. Welcome back, Alva Finn.
Hi, Ryan.
And welcome, Lena Rabarous.
Hi, Ryan. Hi, Alva.
It's great to have you back on this exceptionally cloudy, grim morning in Brussels. And the best news for you guys listening is we're doing this on Thursday morning, so we are going to be completely on point this week. We normally do it on a Wednesday, but we're coming fresh out of the oven for you today. So, I'm nominating for EU WTF Mr. Gunther Oettinger, who is the commissioner from Germany here at the European Commission in Brussels, and he fought a rearguard action this week to block, stop, change, who knows really, a massive package of mobility legislation, which was designed to, for the first time, introduce things like emission limits for vans and trucks in Europe, to push companies to develop more clean energy vehicles, so ones not run on fossil fuels. And Mr. Oettinger has been a longtime friend of the car industry, which, as we know, is based mostly in Germany, here in Europe. I'm wondering, ladies, what do you think could possibly have motivated his decision to force a discussion about this at the European Commission College of Commissioners?
I think the implication is that he has national interests. And when we say national interests, we mean the huge German car industry. And I think this is a problem in general in Brussels, right? You have these commissioners or MEPs, etc., that are meant to be, well, not the MEPs, but the commissioners, really vested in the European, you know, side of things. But they always have these underlying national interests at heart. So I think the implication really is he doing this so that when he goes back, even though it was a lost cause, is he doing this so that when he goes back to Germany, that he will, you know, still have friends in high places, maybe get a cabinet position.
Maybe next month even, because we still have coalition talks going on in Germany, don't we?
Exactly.
Well, possibly that as well. He's securing his next job, whether it's in the government or, don't forget, many of the commissioners, they join the private sector after a while. And possibly as well, he wanted some realistic time and realistic deadlines for the private sector in order to really deliver on all what the commission has asked. So both, is it good, is it bad? We need to see. But
because we don't have the minutes yet. They do take a week or 2 weeks sometime to deliver those minutes.
But possibly as well, it could be like he'll champion one of the private sector. Who knows?
But the thing is, they weren't really even legally binding, right? So, you know, they're kind of aspirational.
And 13 years to hit some of these targets.
Yeah, my view about all of this is that we just don't have the time to allow the private sector to acclimatize to the fact that we have climate change and it's a very real problem. They need to do it now. And I've always thought in my head, the only way that that's going to happen is proper regulation. This wasn't even regulation. So, like, how are we ever going to stop what is going to be apocalyptic future for the planet if we can't even get not legally binding carbon reduction emissions now?
Yes, Alva, but we're used that the commission sometimes comes up with incredible deadlines that are almost you cannot deliver on time. So maybe 13 years or 10 years, I understand that it's very urgent, we have to do it, we have to save the planet, but let's as well look at the other side, that the experts, the industry itself, is being engaged in this conversation, which is something we always lack in talks with the Commission.
Oh, they were very engaged. In fact, the German carmakers called Martin Selmayr in the last couple of days before the debate yesterday. Okay, let's have a very quick mention of another WTF moment. We have in the last week had a second British cabinet minister resign for a bunch of fake and undeclared meetings with Israeli officials. And then, of course, we have Boris Johnson, who has really put his foot in it. I don't even think you could call it a gaffe, where he has mislabeled the trip of a journalist to Iran. And now she faces up to 10 years in prison for spreading propaganda. And the Iranian government were using Boris Johnson's comments to really ramp up the pressure in court on this woman.
Yeah, when I was reading about the Hope Patel thing, there was allegations that she also offered to spend UK aid, which is famously well spent, on
the Israeli army.
On the Israeli army, which is very shocking.
It's a very well-funded army already.
Exactly. It gets so much money already from the likes of the US. So, yeah, that was really shocking.
She ran onto a plane. Sorry, it gets even better. She literally ran away from the Houses of Parliament to get an early plane ahead of her colleague Liam Fox to the same meeting that they were going to in Uganda so that she would just literally be in the air when people wanted to ask her questions about this.
They're keeping us entertained, I think, the British government. I mean, every week we have something like to really either laugh. I think we reached a point that we cannot be shocked anymore. And they're changing faces, so it keeps us busy.
And the ongoing sexual harassment scandals, which has already taken a cabinet minister. I'm sure Theresa May is like, I already have so much on my plate with Brexit. What are all you idiots doing?
But that is a little bit of a thumbs up to the British system of democracy, I would say, because unlike about 20 countries in Europe, Britain is actually having a thorough debate about this now. And it's always a messy discussion, but at least someone has been held accountable for what's going on. And you don't see that really in places like Germany, for example.
Yeah, but then you also think, like, is Theresa May really responding in the way that she should as a female prime minister? I think she could have championed this and made it her own. It could be the other thing that she did apart from the poor Brexit prime minister. I think there was a missed opportunity, particularly from her.
Let's turn for a second to an EU thumbs up moment. We've actually got one this week. That's great. Alva, you wanted to nominate the Paradise Papers.
Yes, I think they're fascinating. So another big kind of cache of documents that implies that the world's rich and famous have been hiding their money in the Cayman Islands, the Isle of Man, a lot of actually British overseas territories, which is interesting. And everybody,
the Queen
from,
is supporting her empire, Alva.
Yeah, the Queen has been implicated in it. Lord Ashcroft. Even I'm looking at this from an Irish lens because I read the Irish news every morning. And they've also, yeah, lots of Irish people have been kind of caught up in this, including the actors of Mrs. Brown's Boys, which is, very...
It's kind of this terrible sitcom. I kind of have some vague memory of never, ever wanting to watch it again.
Yeah, I wouldn't be a fan of it either, but my mother watches it religiously.
Only pay you €2, but if you put it into this offshore account, it can become four.
Yeah, and I think they kind of they didn't really understand what was going on as well, which doesn't surprise me about the actors, to be honest. But yeah, I find this whole thing fascinating. I was always very fascinated by the Panama Papers, the LuxLeaks.
And the EU is actually trying to do something good here on tax avoidance, aren't they?
Yes,
especially
exactly.
Next week they have the tax havens,
the blacklist,
the ECOFIN meeting. Yeah,
some of the countries more associated with this sort of behaviour.
Countries
really
are lobbying and running around in Brussels in order not to be on this list, but. To be honest with you, I'd like to give the thumbs up for the journalists behind that and the power and the allocations and the money that the media outlets that they have put in order to facilitate the work of the journalists behind it. Thank you so much. This is what we need, and this is sort of commitment of the media in order to really preserve our rights as citizens and make sure that we know and make sure that there are ways, whether in the regulators or the commission, to stop it and to expose these countries and these very wealthy people that they just want to be wealthy. So these are the people that we need to give them the thumbs up.
And so that is a special shout out to our colleagues at Süddeutsche Zeitung, the German newspaper that received all of the cache of documents, and others who've always been involved in these projects, which include The Guardian and the BBC as well. There you go. There's actually 97 media organizations, many of them from Europe, but also globally. So thumbs up. Now it's time for our Dear Politico advice session. We've got a quite special one this week. I'm not sure how you're going to react when I read this one out. The subject line of the email was the male side of the coin, and it came from Abundance. I can't tell you who's writing this letter. Dear Politico, I would like to point out the other side of the coin here. Women are also not all innocent and do use their sexuality to gain advances in the workplace. When they do not succeed or get rejected, they will turn things around, fabricate stories, and use the harassment card to ruin their victims, all capitals. The common method in Brussels amongst women is that they, quote, play around with several men as long as they find the one that is best paid and has the highest position. Often they do this for several years or as long as they think their looks still have worth on the market. This point usually comes around the age of 40. It's the main reason why they stay single for many years. Then he goes on to describe a complicated code, which sounds a little bit like dating to me, of how women and men engage with each other, and then says that the ambiguity of the process can be used against men. And if in any part of this rubbish something goes wrong for the woman, she can always state she was right at the beginning, that she's not interested, and can complain against the unfortunate guy. Second, when talking about harassment, we should not forget that male officials are often harassed and bullied at the institutions. It seems as though high-ranking officials get a course in the methods of how to completely ruin a male official's professional and private life. I'll stop there. What's your reaction?
I think Abundance, is that what we're going to call him, sounds very frustrated. Maybe he's been accused of sexual harassment before. He also seems to have quite a dim view of women. I mean, a lot of what he's just described, I would call dating, consensual dating. But I suppose in a way he's struck on something that was remarked on in the UK. There was this list of MPs and staff members going around, some of which whom had sexually harassed people and other people who had actual consensual relationships. Okay, I'm going to spell it out to you. Harassment is harassment. It's a power play. It's when someone receives unwanted attention from you of a sexual nature. If two consenting people are flirting with each other at work, that is not sexual harassment. And I think what you've definitely blurred the lines here. But I think from a female point of view, it's very clear what harassment is. And I don't think there is that much of a grey area. If you make an unwanted come on to a woman, you know very quickly, and then you should immediately stop. And I don't think you can complain about a 2-minute conversation in which you then took that feedback and then didn't do anything. Harassment is usually a lot more. Yeah, it's debasing, humiliating. And then also, I think that this man has possibly been jilted by someone who may or may not be a social climber. But that is up to women. Men do that as well. Everybody, you know, wants, well, some people, this is the way they look at dating, they want the best person for them. And some people like power. So I think this man may have been jilted at some point in the past. Exactly. And is very angry.
Are these alleged behaviours of women people who are just playing the market like any man would in the dating market? Or are they manipulators like he's suggesting?
I don't see any problem here. I mean, we're free. We're free to date and have options and see men and women from different countries, from different categories, institutions. So the problem is that this is a women thing and this is a male thing as well. You can see some of the males, they are dating and they are going out, and we never, with several women, and Brussels is so small, and you can detect that. So there's literally not a problem in my point of view. But I think this Abundance gentleman, unfortunately, I think he had a very horrible experience, that the lady just left him for another colleague. and that he's putting it in this category of harassment. And this is something happens on daily basis. If a woman is being nice and giving you compliments about your tie or your socks, well, you give us as well compliments about our hair and our dresses or our shoes. So this is being nice to each other, being human to one another, and not every single word we're going to transmit it into harassment. Harassment, as Alva just said, it's something persistent, it's something really unwanted, something you would really feel uncomfortable to receive. And let's not confuse that in order just to justify she didn't pick you.
And there's one other question, which might be a cultural difference issue here, because he seems to be a bit hung up on the idea that women might go after several men at once. And I know that, and I don't think that's a man-woman thing. I think that in some places, you know, it's more typical to date one person at a time, and some people get freaked out at the idea that you might be going on dates, drink dates with three different people at once. Whereas for Americans, that's really common. And because Brussels is such a melting pot sort of intersection of things, do you think that sometimes those clashes affect people's reactions in that kind of situation?
Yeah, but I even think that's within cultures. Do you know, I know people who, you know, they come from cultures where this kind of Tinder dating, etc., is very prevalent, but they themselves don't want to date more than one person at the same time. So, I mean, sometimes it's just an individual person thing, just like what we were talking about, like these climbers, people who want to get to kind of the upper echelons of I don't know, I suppose the Brussels bubble by dating. I mean, I am not one of those people, but I know people who are. But that's a personal preference. It's, you know, I don't even think it's massively a cultural difference. Sometimes it's a personal preference. But I did want to say one thing about the last thing that he said, which was he was talking about bullying. And the fact that very high-ranking officials, men and women, do that. And that is true. I don't think that men have a monopoly on bullying in the workplace in Brussels. I definitely don't think that. I know a lot of people who have been bullied by women equally. Maybe it doesn't have a sexual undertone, but it is the case that sometimes people don't have good management skills, and they intimidate rather than try and support and make their staff flourish. So I do think that he's hit on a very good point there. You know, this isn't a gender thing in the workplace, bullying. And people need to be better managers.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, both of you. That's all we've got time for on this episode of EU Confidential. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to us so that you never have to look again. We just come directly to your smartphone or to your laptop. And podcasting is a team effort. So a big shout out, as always, to Rosie Belson, Andrew Gray, and Weidong Lin.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.